Chapter 38. Obeyed. But how can I turn today from this near view of my happiness? He paused a moment and she seemed about to answer, but he hurried on without giving her time. Fulvia, if you ask this sacrifice of me, is there none you will make in return? If you bid me go forth and work for my people, will you not come with me and work for them too? He stretched out his hands, in a gesture that seemed to sum up his infinite need of her, and for a moment they faced each other, silenced by the nearness of great issues. She knew well enough what he offered. According to the code of the day, there was no dishonor in the offer, and it did not occur to her to resent it. But she looked at him sadly, and he read her refusal in the look. The regent's mistress? She said slowly. The key to the treasury, the back door to preferment, the secret trafficker in titles and appointments? That is what I should stand for, and it is not to such services that you must even appear to owe your power. I will not say that I have my own work to do, for the dearest service I could perform would be to help you in yours. But to do this, I must stand aside. To be near you, I must go from you. To love you, I must give you up. She looked him full in the eyes as she spoke. Then she went up to him and kissed him. It was the first kiss he had given him since he had thrown herself in his arms in her father's garden, but now he felt her whole being on her lips. He would have held her fast, forgetting everything in the sweetness of her surrender, but she drew back quickly and, before he could guess her intention, threw open the door of the room to which the Crucis had withdrawn. Signor Abate, she said. The Jesuit came forward. Odo was dimly aware that, for an instant, the two measured each other. Then Fulvia said quietly, His Excellency goes with you to Pianura. What more she said, or what the Crucis answered, he could never afterward recall. He had a confused sense of having cried out a last unavailing protest, faintly, inarticulately, like a man struggling to make himself heard in a dream. Then the room grew dark about him, and in its stead he saw the old chapel at Donna's, with its dimly gleaming shrine, and heard the voice of the chaplain, harsh and yet strangely shaken. Why chief prayer for you is that, should you be raised to this eminence, it may be at a moment when such advancement seems to thrust you in the dust. Odo lifted his head and saw the Crucis standing alone before him. I am ready, he said. Book 4. The Reward. Where are the portraits of those who have perished in spite of their vows? 4.1. One bright March day in the year 1783 the bells of Pianura began to ring at sunrise, and with their first peal the townsfolk were abroad. The city was already dressed for a festival. A canopy of crimson velvet, surmounted by the ducal crown, and by the humilitas of the Valsecas, concealed the columns of the cathedral porch, and fell in royal folds about the featureless porphyry lions who had seen so many successive rulers ascend the steps between their outstretched paws. The frieze of ramping and running animals around the ancient baptistery was concealed by heavy green garlands alternating with religious banners, and every church and chapel had draped its doorway with crimson, and placed above the image of its patron saint the ducal crown of Pianura. No less sumptuous was the adornment of the private dwellings. The great families, the Trescori, the Bolverdi, the Pavepilli, had outdone each other in the display of golden threaded tapestries and Genoese velvets emblazoned with armorial bearings. And even the somber facade of the Boscofolto Palace showed a rich drapery surmounted by the quarterings of the new Marchioness. But it was not only the palace fronts that had put on a holiday dress. The contagion had spread to the poorer quarters, and in many a narrow street and crooked lane, where surely no part of the coming pageant might be expected to pass, the crazy balconies and unglazed windows were decked out with scraps of finery. A yard or two of velvet filched from the state hangings of some noble house, a torn and discolored church banner, even a cast-off sack of brocade or a peasant's holiday kerchief, skillfully draped about the rusty iron, and held in place by pots of clove pink and sweet basil. The half-ruined palace which had once housed Gamba and Momola showed a few shreds of color on its sullen front, and the Abate Crescenti's modest house, wedged in a corner of the city walls, was dressed like the altar of a lady chapel, while even the tanner's quarter by the river displayed its festoons of colored paper and tinsel, ingeniously twisted into the semblance of a crown. For the new duke, who was about to enter his capital in state, was extraordinarily popular with all classes. His popularity, as yet, was mainly due to a general detestation of the rule he had replaced. But such a sentiment gives to a new sovereign an impetus which, if he knows how to use it, will carry him a long way toward success. And among those in the duke's confidence it was rumored that he was qualified not only to profit by the expectations he had raised, but to fulfill them. The last months of the late duke's life had plunged the duchy into such political and financial disorder that all parties were agreed in welcoming a change. Even those that had most to lose by the accession of the new sovereign, or most to fear from the policy he was known to favor, preferred the possibility of new evils to a continuance of present conditions. The expertest angler in troubled waters may find waters too troubled for his sport, and under a government where power is passed from hand to hand like the handkerchief in a children's game, the most adroit time server may find himself grasping the empty air. It would indeed have been difficult to say who had ruled during the year preceding the duke's death. Prime ministers had succeeded each other like the clowns in a harlequinade. Just as the church seemed to have gained the upper hand, some mysterious revulsion of feeling would fling the duke toward Tresker and the liberals. And when these had attempted, by some trifling concession to popular feeling, to restore the credit of the government, their sovereign, seized by religious scruples, would hastily recall the clerical party. So the administration staggered on, reeling from one policy to another, clutching now at this support and now at that, while Austria and the Holy See hung on its steps, awaiting the inevitable fall. A cruel winter and a fresh outbreak of the silkworm disease had aggravated the misery of the people, while the mounting extravagance of the Duchess had put a last strain on the exhausted treasury. The consequent increase of the salt tax roused such popular fury that Father Ignazio, who was responsible for the measure, was dismissed by the panic-stricken duke, and Tresker, as usual, called in to repair his rival's mistake. But it would have taken a greater statesman than Tresker to reach the root of such evils, and the new minister succeeded neither in pacifying the people nor in reassuring his sovereign. Meanwhile, the duke was sinking under the mysterious disease which had hung upon him since his birth. It was hinted that his last hours were darkened by hallucinations, and the pious pictured him as haunted by profligate visions, while the freethinkers maintained that he was the dupe of priestly jugglery. Toward the end there was the inevitable rumor of Aquitofana, and the populace cried out that the Jesuits were at work again. It seems more probable, however, that His Highness, who had assisted at the annual festival of the Madonna del Monte, and had mingled on foot with the swarm of devotees thronging thither from all parts, had contracted a pestilent disorder from one of the pilgrims. Certain it is that death came in a dreadful form. The Duchess, alarmed for the health of Prince Ferrand, fled with him to the dower house by the Piana, and the strange nature of His Highness's distemper caused many to follow her example. Even the Duke's servants, and the quacks that lived on his bounty, were said to have abandoned the death chamber, and an English traveler passing through Pianura boasted that, by the payment of a small fee to the palace porter, he had obtained leave to enter His Highness's closet and peer through the doorway at the dying man. However this may be, it would appear that the Duke's confessor, a monk of the Barnabite order, was not to be found when His Highness called for him, and the servant sent forth in haste to fetch a priest returned, strangely enough, with the Abate Crescenti, whose suspected orthodoxy had so long made him the object of the Duke's detestation. He it was who alone witnessed the end of that tormented life, and knew upon what hopes or fears it closed. Meanwhile, it appeared that the Duchess's precautions were not unfounded, for Prince Ferrand presently sickened of the same malady which had cut off his father, and when the regent, traveling post-haste, arrived in Pianura, he had barely time to pass from the duke's obsequies to the deathbed of the heir. Etiquette required that a year of mourning should elapse between the accession of the new sovereign and his state entry into his capital, so that if Duke Odo's character and intentions were still matter of conjecture to his subjects, his appearance was already familiar to them. His youth, his good looks, his open mien, his known affability of manner, were so many arguments in his favor with an impressionable and impulsive people, and it was perhaps natural that he should interpret as a tribute to his principles the sympathy which his person aroused. It is certain that he fancied himself, at that time, as well acquainted with his subjects as they believed themselves to be with him, and the understanding supposed to exist was productive of equal satisfaction to both sides. The new duke had thrown himself with extraordinary zeal into the task of loving and understanding his people. It had been his refuge from 100 doubts and uncertainties, the one clearly defined object in an obscure and troubled fate. And their response had, almost immediately, turned his task into a pleasure. It was so easy to rule, if one's subjects loved one. And so easy to be loved, if only one loved enough in return. If he did not, like the Pope, describe himself to his people as the servant of the servants of God, he at least longed to make them feel that this new gospel of service was the base on which all sovereignty must henceforth repose. It was not that his first year of power had been without moments of disillusionment. He had had more than one embittering experience of intrigue and perfidy, more than one glimpse of the pitfalls besetting his course. But his confidence in his own powers, and his faith in his people remained unshaken, and with two such beliefs to sustain him, it seemed as though no difficulties would prove insurmountable. Such at least was the mood in which, on the morning of his entry into Pianura, he prepared to face his subjects. Strangely enough, the state entry began at Ponte di Po, the very spot where, on a stormy midnight some 7 years earlier, the new duke had landed, a fugitive from his future realm. Here, according to an ancient custom, the sovereign awaited the arrival of his ministers and court, and then, taking seat in his state barge, proceeded by water to Pianura, followed by an escort of galleys. A great tent hung with tapestries had been set up on the river bank, and here Odo awaited the approach of the barge. As it touched at the landing stage he stepped out, and his prime minister, Count Tresker, advanced toward him, accompanied by the dignitaries of the court. Tresker had aged in the intervening years. His delicate features had withered like a woman's, and the fine irony of his smile had taken an edge of cruelty. His face suggested a worn engraving, the lines of which have been deepened by a too incisive instrument. The functionaries attending him were, with few exceptions, the same who had figured in a like capacity at the late sovereign's court. With the passing of the years they had grown heavier or thinner, more ponderous or stiffer in their movements, and as they advanced, in their splendid but unwieldy court dress, they seemed to Odo like superannuated marionettes whose springs and wires have rusted from disuse. The barge was a magnificent gilded bucentaur, presented to the late duke's father by the Doge of Venice, and carved by his serenity's most famous sculptors in wood. Tritons and sea goddesses encircled the prow enthroned above the stern, and the interior of the deck house was adorned with delicate relievi, and painted by Tiepolo with scenes from the myth of Amphitrite. Here the new duke seated himself, surrounded by his household, and presently the heavy craft, rowed by 60 galley slaves, was moving slowly up the river toward Pianura. In the clear spring light the old walled city, with its domes and towers, rose pleasantly among budding orchards and fields. Close at hand, were the crenellations of Braxiford's keep, and just beyond, the ornate cupola of the royal chapel, symbolizing in their proximity the successive ambitions of the Dusel race, while the round-arched campanile of the cathedral and the square tower of the medieval town hall sprang up side by side, marking the center of the free city which the Valsecas had subjugated. It seemed to the new duke, who was given to such reflections, that he could read his race's history in that broken skyline, but he was soon snatched from its perusal by the cheers of the crowd who thronged the river bank to greet his approach. As the Bucentaur touched at the landing stage and Odo stepped out on the red carpet strewn with flowers, while cannon thundered from the walls, and the bells burst into renewed jubilation, he felt himself for the first time face to face with his people. The very ceremonial which in other cases kept them apart was now a means of closer communication, for it was to show himself to them that he was making a public entry into his capital, and it was to see him that the city had poured forth her shouting throngs. The shouts rose and widened as he advanced, enveloping him in a mounting tide of welcome, in which cannon, bells and voices the decreed, and the spontaneous acclamations were indistinguishably merged. In like manner, approbation of his person was mingled with a simple enjoyment of the show, of which he formed a part, and it must have taken a more experienced head than Odo's to distinguish between the two currents of enthusiasm on which he felt himself swept forward. The pageant was indeed brilliant enough to justify the popular transport, and the fact that the new duke formed a worthy center to so much magnificence was not lost on his splendor-loving subjects. The late sovereign had so long held himself aloof that the city was unaccustomed to such shows, and as the procession wound into the square before the cathedral, where the thickest of the crowd was massed, the very pealing of the church bells was lost in the roar of human voices. Don Serafino, the bishop's nephew, and now master of the horse, rode first, on a splendid charger, preceded by four trumpets and followed by his esquires. Then came the court dignitaries, attended by their pages and staffiarii in gala liveries, the marshals with their staves, the masters of ceremony, and the clergy mounted on mules trapped with velvet, each led by two running footmen. The duke rode next, alone and somewhat pale. Two pages of arms, helmeted and carrying lances, walked at his horse's bridle, and behind him came his household and ministers, with their gentlemen and a long train of servants, followed by the regiment of light horse which closed the procession. The houses surrounding the square afforded the best point of view to those unwilling to mix with the crowd in the streets, and among the spectators thronging the windows and balconies, and leaning over the edge of the leads, were many who, from one motive or another, felt a personal interest in the new duke. The Marchioness of Boscofolto had accepted a seat in the windows of the Pevepilai Palace, which formed an angle of the square, and she and her hostess, the same lady who had been relieved of her diamond necklace by footpads suspected of wearing the Duchess's livery, sat observing the scene behind the garlanded balconies of the piano noble. In the mezzanine windows of a neighboring wine shop, the bookseller Andreoni, with half a dozen members of the philosophical society to which Odo had belonged, peered above the heads of the crowd thronging the arcade, and through a dormer of the leads Carlo Gamba, the assistant in the Dusel library, looked out on the triumph of his former patron. Among the church dignities grouped about His Highness was Father Ignazio, the late Duke's confessor, now prior of the Dominicans, and said to be withdrawn from political life. Seated on his richly trapped mule, he observed the scene with impassive face, while from his place in the long line of minor clergy, the Abate Crescenti, with eyes of infinite tenderness and concern, watched the young Duke solemnly ascending the cathedral steps. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.